with stigma comes a kind of different sort of discourse around what affirmative action really is and how we, I think it's worth thinking about changing or revising the terminology to just get people to understand what's going on. What we're trying to do is stop mediocrity from dominating.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Hi, everyone. Welcome so much to this Haymarket live event. I'm Anthony Arnov. I'm one of the editors at Haymarket and one of the co-founders of the press. We're really excited to welcome back two speakers who have been frequent contributors to our Haymarket live programming and who have very important insights in this moment where we're experiencing renewed and relentless attacks on the teaching and understanding of the history of Black social struggles and movements in this country. I want to thank a couple of people at the start of this. The book, Our History Has Always Been Contraband in Defense of Black Studies, was a collaboration between Haymarket, Kaepernick Publishing, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. We're so grateful for that collaboration and all of the hard work that they put into making this book possible and also making it possible to make it available as a free ebook. It is still available as a free ebook from Haymarket, from Kaepernick Publishing, from the website of Marguerite Casey Foundation, which is also a bit hilarious when if you look at the reaction of the right-wing press to the publication of this book, among the many attacks that have come the way of the editors and publishers of this project was the fake outrage machine being very upset about the price of the book at a time when we were giving it away for free. These are, of course, the same people who want to ban books and fire librarians and punish teachers and fire teachers and keep people from being able to read books like this. But they were very upset that it was expensive in their mind, even though it was free. there's also a free study guide that you can download on our website. I want to thank a couple of other people, Amanda, who's doing the live captioning tonight, John, our producer and engineer, Rachel, who worked on the study guide, Dow, who did amazing work helping to pull this book together so quickly. And of course, Colin Kaepernick, Robin D.G. Kelly, and Kianga Yamada Taylor for their vision and contributions in this book, including the original essays that they contributed, as well as the brilliant curation and editing. And with that, I'm very pleased to turn it over to Kianga.
Thank you, Anthony. Hi, Robin. It's great
to... Hey, how are you doing? Great seeing you.
Great seeing you again. So let's get started. I wanted to get together to talk about the book in a new context, which is to say that for the last, I mean, we could say since, you know, 2017, you know, right after Trump, that there's been this relentless attack on Black history more recently. Black studies, the study of race and racism in the history of the United States, that was kind of ever present, maybe inchoate. And then in 2019, with the publication of the 1619 Project, began to become even more focused, first around 1619, and then in the aftermath of the uprisings 3 years ago in the summer of 2020, it began to diffuse into any and all discussion of race, which Chris Ruffino, you know, organized around hysteria around what they described as critical race theory, which was any utterance of race. So that was the context within which, you know, we got together with Colin Kaepernick to publish this book, Our History Has Always Been Contraband, to talk about Black studies and to contextualize why this attack was happening right now. Black studies has always been under attack, but in its latest iteration, this was the kind of broader context. So in some ways, it was fitting that in the midst of all of this, the Supreme Court intervenes and banishes the use of affirmative action, the use of race or histories of racism in college admissions in such a way that it leaves us to wonder, or led me to wonder, what does race even mean in the United States anymore? There's a, in some sense, there's a tension in the John Roberts speaking for the majority, and then Clarence Thomas, you know, who's sort of the fulfillment of, it seems like, his career-long ambition to destroy affirmative action, where John Roberts tries to speak with some restraint and ends with, this doesn't mean that we can never, you know, talk about race, but as individuals within a narrative of someone's overall life experience, certainly nothing institutional, nothing structural, and definitely nothing systemic. And in fact, to mention race in any of those other context is to, in fact, be racist. So there was that. But then Clarence Thomas's, I don't know if you've read the his concurring opinion. It's just a denial that race right. factor in anything. And so, you know, he says that there's no causal link between racial discrimination and what Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Jackson Brown describes as the gulf between the experiences of ordinary Black people and their white peers. Thomas says there's no connection between racial discrimination and racial disparities. People are discriminated against for all sorts of reasons. We don't know that race has anything to do with it. I mean, just almost a caricature of himself, almost comical if the consequences weren't so severe. And so while in some ways this decision is narrowly construed, right? It's just about college admissions in, it's just about college admissions. You know, it's also obvious that this speaks with some level, maximum level of authority about the meaning of race. And racism in our society. And so I'm wondering if you could just talk about the significance of this decision in lieu of that. You know, like 3 years after the largest demonstrations in American history against racism, where the phrase systemic racism right. became absorbed into the mainstream, we have the highest legal authority in the United States saying no. In fact, there is no systemic racism. What does all this mean?
No, it's a really good question. And incidentally, if you've, I don't know if you've seen the documentary on Clarence Thomas in his own words. It explains the psychology behind his concurrence, you know, which is that he has issues with this idea that somehow affirmative action, you know, it's an old story. Yeah. Affirmative action is denies him his mm-hmm. value. You know, somehow it's a leg up. And of course, what we know is that the assault on affirmative action begins as soon as the word enters the federal government. You know, I mean, the Bakke case is like, 1978. Mm-hmm. And even in the early 70s, when you have, the most significant, to me, the more significant cases of affirmative action are not necessarily admissions, but labor. As you know, because I mean, you've written about this. I mean, you think about the EEOC and what it was actually doing, getting pressure from black workers and organized labor. They sued U.S. Steel. Same thing with Detroit Edison. They weren't promoting black workers. They sued. And that is where you get the beginnings of a robust affirmative action policy. But the thing about admissions, as you point out, it is narrowly focused, and it hits that psychology of the kind of imposter syndrome, the psychology saying that the purpose of affirmative action is to allow less than worthy or mediocre people into these institutions. But what we know is that affirmative action is about opening doors so that people who are worthy could take seats where all these mediocre white people have been like shuffling in left and right. And they still do it. Mm-hmm. They still, I mean, the whole struggle around legacy is just one example. But the idea that, you know, that we have less than worthy or really inadequate intellectually in other ways, white people, middle class and upper class white people in these positions, is what affirmative action is trying to reverse. That is to create an even playing field. But that's not the way it gets positioned. And so having said that, when we think about what is race in that context, one thing I'm always reminded of, that the only people who really, really, really believe in race as biology are white nationalists. Mm. I mean, we've been spending our lives talking about race as a social construction, and even people who may not be in our field or in our world have a sense that what they're dealing with is not race. They're dealing with racism. Mm. And again, we you and I know that, but it's worth putting it on the table because you ask a lot of Black people, you know, I'm an individual, have my own unique things. Yes, I'm Black, they'll be proud of that or embarrassed by it, whatever. But in the end, when you start to list the things that are barriers, these are structural barriers that are based on not necessarily racial difference per se, but the meaning assigned to this mythic racial difference. And that is the fundamental question. It's like, what does racism mean? And as you said, I mean, we're in this, I know it's cliche to say this, but this is really Orwellian, when racism is anti-racism.
Right.
Anti-racism has become the new racism. If you say it, you're being racist. If you attribute anything to racism, you're being racist.
Right.
And that is the danger. And what's scary to me is that it does work. It's working in a sense that, I mean, even Black people I know, mm-hmm. I don't know well, but the ones I end up talking to. I know of. Do say things like, well, you know, don't talk about racism because, you know, we're all individuals and therefore to talk about racism is to be racist. And I just, you know. So that to me is one of the things that we're confronting. And one of the things that, of course, Black studies has, and ethnic studies more generally, has really tried to counter this idea that race is kind of the real thing that determines value, as opposed to racism as a thing that devalues through a mythology, you know, a mythology that has certain material benefits for certain classes.
One of the things that I've been thinking about with this is there are a couple things. One is that this decision, it seems to me, has produced very little outcry. I think that there was the kind of initial, and first, I think that this has been predicted for quite a while. Second, I think that aside from the initial reporting in the, you know, the first few days afterwards, there's been very little, you know, kind of protest or sustained outcry around this. Of course, there are people, you know, who are talking about it, who are writing about it, who are opposed to it. But it hasn't, it, you know, days after the abortion decision was rendered, you know, there were thousands of people in the streets and in demonstrations in cities across the country. And that hasn't been the case here. And I saw, I was mentioning this to you earlier, that there were polls that were published in the Washington Post that showed, you know, there's an overwhelming majority of white people who agreed with the decision. But there was nearly, what is this, half, 47% of Black people who also agreed that affirmative action should be banned in college admissions. And interestingly, I thought in that same poll, only 11% of Black Americans said that affirmative action had affected them positively. And so I've, you know, been thinking about what some of this what some of this means, and how affirmative action went from what you said earlier as a bottom-up demand from Black workers who were excluded both from government jobs and then, importantly, from jobs in that were dominated by trade unions.
Right.
So carpentry, construction, in particular, and there's this you know, it's exemplified by a horrible statement made by the president of the AFL, CIO, and George Meany, you know, who said, you know, in the plumbers union, he was a plumber, that, you know, we didn't think that we ever needed to let the N-words in, right? Just the head of the AFL-CIO. And so between the two, you have, over the course of the 20th century, right, Black workers are moving into, quote unquote, industrial centers. They're moving into places for work, for the purposes of work, and then are confronted immediately outside of the South with this virulent racism that keeps them locked out of jobs. And so as early as 1941, with under the threat of A. Philip Randolph leading Black workers to what he said the front lawn of the White House, you get the first kind of movement from the U.S. government since the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, to do something about job discrimination. So Roosevelt has the executive order that bans discrimination in war industries and in defense industries. This is World War II. And then creates the Fair Employment Practices Committee, which is supposed to enforce this executive order. And then there's Truman calls for some similar government oversight that fights discrimination that allows Black workers into government jobs. And then there's the 1964 Civil Rights Act, right, which finally bans racial discrimination. But all of this is motivated by the presence, the activity, the activism of Black workers. And somehow we get from the demands of Black workers to the demands of not just students, right? Because someone sent me something that there's like over 5,000 colleges and universities in the United States, and 70% of them just admit whoever applies to them. So there's like a 50% admissions rate. And it's only at these, you know, a small number of elite schools where there's this competitive attempt, you know, to get into these schools. So we've gone from Black workers to how do we get into these narrow, you know, small number of programs, which is, of course, not to say that we shouldn't have entry into these small number of programs, but it might have something to do with how this program is conceived of, even by Black people, as having nothing to do with, you know, most Black people. I don't know. This is just something I'm thinking about in terms of, like, why is there so little reaction to this, what seems like, you know, a very big decision?
Right. No, I think this is a really good question. And let me, I've been thinking about it too, in two different ways. One, of course, is this question of stigma. And this is the Clarence Thomas problem, but it's a lot of problems. It's stigma has been attached to affirmative action from its inception. And so it's a kind of ideological war against actually recognizing what it does. That, you know, most people, if you ask them what affirmative action is, they'll say things like it's, what's the phrase they use nowadays? They talk about they use race as, they treat it as if it's a kind of a boost, as opposed to, you know, actually being truly colorblind. And that what I mean by that is that, you know, you talk about race-based, you know, affirmative action, which is to say that race should be a factor in putting you up at the top, when in fact that's not how it works. What it does is it tells search committees and admissions committees that, look, you can't just go to the normal people that you've been going to before, because that normative, you know, pool, these are basically mostly white men and some white women as well, but they're not necessarily, they don't always look like all of us. I mean, all of us. And so if you think about all the different skills and you know, talents and benefits, you know, we're all there. We all should be in, you know, everyone should be admitted. Open admissions is not a terrible thing. It's a great thing. But to go back to stigma works. Stigma worked, I think, around welfare rights. You know, one of the amazing thing about the welfare, as you know, I'm telling what you already know, but the National Welfare Rights Movement did something that was extraordinary. They removed the stigma through grassroots organizing, removed it. And suddenly you have movements making demands, expanding the welfare rolls, and then it got rolled back. The stigma got attached and imposed and elevated and a ballooned to the point where, you know, when Clinton signed the Personal Responsibility Act attacking welfare, there was protest, there was opposition, but there wasn't like massive. And part of it's because, you know, the Democrats, you know, and not just the right Democrats, but everyone has kind of come to the point where, you know, well, welfare as we know it is really a form of dependency.
Right.
And so you have people who, you have white people on welfare, you said, we need to get rid of welfare. You got Black and brown people on welfare, said, we need to get rid of welfare, without actually recognizing what it is. What it is at least the modicum of trying to provide at least a floor for life,
right,
for living. Just that's basically it. Like we call it basic income, but basic income that's attached to all this policing and surveillance.
Right.
So to me, the lack of response to affirmative action, except for the people that we know, you know, African-American Policy Forum, have been fighting this battle forever, ever, ever, and they're still like at the forefront. The lack of response, I think, is both terrifying, but to be expected given the question of stigma. But I think stigma, with stigma comes a kind of different sort of discourse around what affirmative action really is. And how we, I think it's worth thinking about changing or revising the terminology to just get people to understand what's going on. What we're trying to do is stop mediocrity from dominating. It's a very basic thing. And look, I've written this before. You know, we work in universities where we're surrounded by so many mediocre white people. It's not funny. I mean, it's amazing. Like I run into people, administrators, sometimes colleagues, but mostly administrators, are like, how did you get here? Like, well, who did you pay to get this job? You know? And so meanwhile, I'm running into all these young kids who are in various programs that I have an attachment to, who don't have a prospect for going to one of those schools, you know, the, one of the elite schools that everyone's trying to get into. And yet they're way smarter than a whole bunch of my students who sit in my classes at UCLA, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's the reality we don't see, you know? And if we can just get rid of this, it's not just getting rid of stigma, it's also returning back to the question of understanding, again, structural racism.
I wonder also, you know, I think stigma is powerful. I think also the way that the right shifted, how they critique affirmative action, which went, I think, from the 1960s and the early 1970s, from unqualified black people being allowed in, to reverse racism, and to the holding up Asian Americans as the true victims of affirmative action, like highly qualified minorities who aren't the right minority. And why is this just a special program for black people? And so I think that that is part of the way that the discourse on this shifted is important. But I also think that, you know, there's been a kind of one-sided attack on this notion that the government should be involved in preference, in promoting the entry of some people over others. And so, you know, I think that when it has been characterized that, and not as a kind of reparative response, as redress to the kind of formal exclusion. I mean, this is what is so outrageous, particularly with the UNC decision, University of North Carolina, where black people were forbidden by law to enter the university until the 1960s, until two generations ago, right? And that is completely, it is completely obscured. And so the notion of redress and repair for past harm, you know, which is also a kind of way that colorblindness works, which is to say, we ended racism on Monday, and on Tuesday, it's, you know, everybody is on the level playing field and starting from the same starting position. And there's no attempt to actually understand or come to terms with what it meant to have 300 years of formal racism, of legal subjugation, And this, to me, is where this history of the current suppression of history is so important.
Right.
Because if you don't know that, right, if you don't, for all of the criticisms of 1619, what it has done is give us a historical orientation to understand the longevity of this. Because if you don't know that history, then it does seem like, well, this is unfair. You know, right. Why is the government helping one group of people when there is widespread deprivation and inequality in the United States?
Right.
And so
right.
I think that the way that the right has dominated this discussion about what affirmative action is has helped to distort it, even in the minds of people who might benefit from it or for whom right. these programs are directed in the first place.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Abolition for the People: The Movement for a Future Without Policing and Prisons, edited by Colin Kaepernick. Abolition for the People brings together 30 essays representing a diversity of voices: political prisoners, grassroots organizers, scholars, and relatives of those killed by the anti-Black terrorism of policing and prisons. Powered by courageous hope and imagination, Abolition for the People provides a blueprint and vision for creating an abolitionist future where communities can be safe, valued, and truly free. Another world is possible, Kaepernick writes. A world grounded in love, justice, and accountability. A world grounded in safety and good health. A world grounded in meeting the needs of the people. As Combahee River Collective co-founder Barbara Smith says of the collection, Kaepernick has assembled a community of visionary thinkers who unequivocally show that the path to freedom requires abolition. Find Abolition for the People at haymarketbooks.org.
Right, right. No, I think that's great. And in fact, I was laughing because, you know, these same people who have moved toward the sort of discourse of reverse racism are the ones that invoke Dr. King,
know,
to say, and I just want to tell, the audience should know this, but since we're talking about history, I mean, I would just, if you have a chance, read his speech from The Other America or read Where Do You Go From Here, which is, this is late King.
Yep.
And not to say he didn't, this is new for him. He's been making this argument for a long time. And he says, you know, this is supposedly, you know, like 1967, 68. Racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realized. And he goes on to say, to talk about the kind of so-called white backlash and its impact. But he says, you know, he says, white backlash is merely a new name for an old phenomenon. And his examples are the emancipation of enslaved people without land, while, quote, and this is King, giving millions of acres of land in the West and Midwest to its white peasants from Europe. Mm-hmm. That's Dr. King. That's Dr. King that the right is, of course, invoking as their evidence for a so-called colorblind society according to their means, which, of course, colorblindness is not colorblindness. It's basically white rule. And the sad thing, just a side note, how our APA community is being used by white nationalists, basically by, you know, conservatives as a kind of Trojan horse to basically defeat affirmative action. And that's another story. We could talk about that. Janelle Wong has written some amazing stuff about that. There's a lot of writing on that. But what I want to get to very quickly, this is building on what you just said, is, you know, I live in California. California, of course, is the home of Ward Connerly, the Negro brainchild of, you know, this kind of anti-affirmative action, this kind of rescue of value, you know, from the kind of clutches of affirmative action. So California is one of the places where, you know, I teach at a state university, so the Supreme Court ruling had no impact because we've already been practicing this. And whenever there, and we have a faculty member in our law school named Richard Sander. Richard Sander, who's basically a kind of, he calls himself a liberal, but he's kind of like the voice of Ward Connolly in terms of making arguments that Black and brown students do better at second tier and third tier universities and colleges than they do at first tier. I mean, based on evidence that is very questionable. But he's also pushing for this. So just to give you a little story, a few years ago, Richard Sander had written this article. Ward Connolly had been calling for an investigation of the UC system, specifically UCLA, because we've been sneaking in too many Black students. You know, so the fact that our Black admissions had gone up, Ward Connolly's position was, and Richard Sander's position, especially Connolly, was that something is fishy going on at UCLA. There's no way you can increase the Black enrollment, Black admissions, unless you're cheating.
Right.
And they're calling for investigation. So this, here's the sad thing. This is that stuff we can expect, as absurd as it is. But the sad thing is that, you know, students organize a rally. And I went to this rally, and a lot of the students spoke, Black, brown students. And instead of saying, you know, what we need to do is roll back Proposition 209, which was the, you know, the proposition that basically eliminated affirmative action in state universities and colleges. Instead, it was saying, I deserve to be here. My SAT scores were X. My grades were X. Why? You know, and I was like, why are you saying that? But you're making the argument that this is a meritocracy, and therefore you merit being here. And so no one should question that. And on the surface of it, I understand that. But a kind of politics, the kind of vision of a different future is to say, we all belong here. And so what if my SAT scores weren't that high? You know, I'm doing something here. I'm making something. Creating something, being here to learn. Why shouldn't we open the doors for everybody? Why don't we just eliminate Prop 209? But no one made that case. And it was sad to me because, again, it's the power of the discourse that somehow affirmative action is damaging us, even when the idea was to reduce the damage that have kept us out, you know, like you said, with UNC, two generations of just accepting Black students for the first time, you know?
So I have this raises a question for me that might be slightly different for state schools. So there were similar affirmative action decisions in Michigan, now North Carolina, California being the kind of original test case most recently. And so is there a way in which one is there space for a left critique of affirmative action, which is to say that do these programs kind of reinforce a scarcity model that exists in these state institutions where we should be saying open admissions, everyone has the right in a society that is structured to, you know, benefit those with a bachelor's degree, that everyone has a right to go to a college, a good college, a state-funded institution, and that affirmative action, in some ways, I think there are two things. One is that it kind of preserves this idea that there's limited space, mm-hmm. and we have to fight over the spaces that exist, and whether there's also, you know, it's not challenging anything really, right? We want to be included, not excluded.
Right.
But we're certainly not questioning any of the existing dynamics once we are included. We're just saying, don't keep us out of this deranged system that you have created in this you know, this meritocracy that you claim to be concocting. It just says, let us into it. And right. So is there a critique to be made with these programs?
Yeah, you just laid it out. And you know what's so great? I mean, I completely agree. And this is something that I think a lot of us have been saying. And there's models. I mean, City College is an amazing model. This is a film that's out now called The Five Demands. Mm. And, you know, City College is a wonderful film. City College is important because they not only fought from the community perspective for open admissions and succeeded. Open admissions and free tuition. I mean, you know, no one's paying anything to go there, and it's open admissions. But they created. I mean, this was the place where, you know, Audre Lorde and Margaret Prescott, and I mean, there's a whole bunch of people who were there.
Harvard
teaching.
On the Hudson.
Right, yeah. Harvard on the Hudson, who basically created programs for, you know, welfare recipients, many of whom are, you know, mothers. They created programs for students who don't necessarily have high school diplomas to help them prepare for admission to college and to succeed. Basically focus on the working classes. Mm-hmm. And City College has a long history of kind of working class radicalism. But in the 60s and 70s, you think about all the people who came out of City College in that period of open admissions, many of whom would have ended up maybe in jail, you know, and yet ended up being amazing writers and poets and scholars and intellectuals and scientists. Mm-hmm. So there's a model for that, and that is a rejection of affirmative action, and instead of kind of, you know, again, the scarcity model where you sort of create, you basically eliminate, you create space for what people think of as quotas, or never really quotas, but you think about that, as opposed to saying, open up the doors, rethink education altogether, create programs so that the people who have been historically left out are the ones who could benefit from a college education, and limit the star system in which a Harvard and Yale and Princeton education is worth way more. Although I have to say, you know, I know you've had experience at these Ivy League schools, but what I paid for my college when I went to Long Beach State, which is a state university, in between 1980 and 83, which was $90 a semester, that the value of my education, yeah, compared to paying what my daughter paid, what I paid at Wesleyan, which was upwards of $70,000, I'm like, I got the better. I got not just a better bargain, but it wasn't that the education at the Ivies are that much better. You know, right. It's not like 1,000 times better, not even 100 times better, not even 50 times better. And yet that's the going rate. And so, of course, the final conclusion is that, yes, there's a left critique, and it involves crushing capitalism.
Well, you know, I went to City College for 3 years, and when I went was during a period in which it was in the 90s, and the CUNY itself was being gentrified and retrenched, and so you know, the 1970s and the struggle around open admissions then was always a touchstone. The ways in which it ended, right, which is during the fiscal crisis in New York in 1975, 1976. This is when the state used that crisis as a way to end open admissions and to, you know, begin a long march towards reconfiguring the 4-year colleges within the CUNY system into places that were attractive to the middle class, and to really root out the working class Black and Puerto Rican students that had taken advantage of this free education. And so that was open and available to all, you know, who were interested in it. And so I think that, you know, in many ways, affirmative action, I think is the critique doesn't mean that, for me at least, thus we should get rid of it.
Right.
The critique is that it doesn't go far enough, right? Because we can look and say from the 1960s, when these programs first started to be implemented, to today, that there has been a certain level of success that is undeniable, right?
That's
like
right.
The flowering of the Black middle class, which can be measured in all manner of ways, but whose highest expression has to be the presidency of the United States, mm-hmm. the largest number of Black elected officials in American history. I think in 1967, there was 0.2% of the Black population was making over $250,000 a year. Today, it's 7.5%. And so there are things that you can point to that speak to some measure of progress that is inconceivable without the 1964 Civil Rights Act,
right.
and without the EEOC, and without the affirmative action programs that are created to open those spaces in both colleges and universities, but also throughout, you know, corporate America, the federal government, and all of the rest of it. But it's not enough.
Right.
It hasn't been enough because you still have, you know, the disproportionate number of Black people who live in poverty, that mm-hmm. Black women dominate the statistics when it comes to who is most likely to be evicted. All of the barometers by which you measure the quality of life in the United States, Black people's existence is defined by deprivation.
Right.
And so that has not been, it has not been enough. And I think the scarcity model of allowing a few people into this or that profession or into having this or that number of jobs, it's one thing to do that when the economy is expanding.
Right.
It's another thing to do that when the economy is contracting, when right. the lifespan of working class people is gone into decline. Then it also seems like a recipe for setting people. I mean, this is what scarcity does, right? It forces us to fight over the few things they tell us that exist for ordinary people. And so I don't know what all of that means, except to say that to me, this is part of me trying to understand why in this particular political moment, affirmative action is not this kind of rallying cry
right.
that people are gathering around as what we need to do next.
Exactly, exactly.
The movement against racism.
Exactly. Exactly. And let me just add one other thing to that, because you just reminded me of something else. I mean, the truth is we know from our students and from the people we just deal with, a college education now is not getting you $250,000 a year. It's not. In fact, it might get you a job at Starbucks. Right.
And that's about
and
it.
You get debt, and then you end up in these low-wage jobs. So here we're dealing with a situation in which you have, even when you have an expanding economy, in the neoliberal order is one in which expansion doesn't necessarily lead to or result in wage increases. It doesn't result in lower housing costs. It doesn't, in fact, it just results in the concentration of wealth, you know, and that's something we know. But now it's like, I could understand why affirmative action fighting for it could feel hollow when you're turning around and see all these people with college degrees
yes.
Who are basically baristas, right? Or they're, you know, working at Amazon. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, there's a kind of ceiling now that makes it difficult. And then you have all the people that, you know, we know and we train and we teach who say, I want to be an organizer. And they go into that world and they're living in poverty under huge duress in terms of the workload and the pressures. And so we're witnessing that as well. And there's a kind of feeling of helplessness when the pathway to just a living comfortable life, a living wage and a comfortable life has kind of shut down with degrees, with more than one degree. And then, of course, you got the precariat in terms of teaching, university teaching, which is the future. My wife, as you know, is on strike right now because she's a member of SAG-AFTRA. And here you got a situation where all these amazing, talented people, most of them can't make a living. The vast majority, I think maybe 2 or 3% actually make a real living. And they're on strike because in this particular economic and political moment, they're trying to struggle for the right to hold on to their image and voice, you know, without it being taken from them and used through AI to basically make movies that they have no control over, or which they get residuals that are pennies. Right. You know, and of course, I get the mail every day, and my wife gets these checks that are not even worth the stamp, checks for 4 cents, 10 cents. So this future doesn't look great, which means that, again, we're back to square one, which is we cannot fight to bring students of color in if they're going to sleep in their cars. Mm. You know, and that's what's happening here at UCLA, you know, that's untenable.
Right.
And it's not just Black students.
Right.
You know, so that's one of the dilemmas we're dealing with. And that's one of the reasons why people should read this book. Mm-hmm. Our history has always been contraband, because some of the lessons, the historical lessons of struggle, are here, going back from David Walker all the way up to some of the more recent essays dealing with what we're dealing with today.
Right.
Advertisement.
Yes. So let's, I don't know if there are questions in the audience that we want to turn to. I did want to ask, as I think about this as well, what is the social movement, the response of, or what should it be, of students to not just the attack on affirmative action and the idea that everyone belongs on these college campuses, but also the attack on curriculum. And just, there's so many different battlefronts in higher education right now. There's the attack on tenure. There is the attack, continuing attack on contingent adjunct labor. There is the attack on other staff and labor on college campuses that is often hidden and obscured. There is the, you know, somehow through this fight around affirmative action, university presidents and administrators make themselves out to be the big liberals and, you know, the good guys in the battle. And yet the question never comes up. Why is tuition rising 10, 15 times the rate of inflation every year? Like you mentioned, you know, Wesleyan and all of these schools, $70,000, $75,000 a year in tuition costs. And then we have the attack on the effort of to relieve student debt, to get rid of and cancel the debt. And then the administrators disappear, right? They're the good guys in the affirmative action struggle, and then they're completely absent in the struggle against student debt. And so in the midst of all of this, where is our mass student movement? You know, that's what I'm wondering about.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I will say this, and I'm very proud of this, and you know it too, is that the one place where I think students did an excellent job of coming out is supporting unions on campus.
Mm.
That's the one place. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's a very important lesson, because you have undergraduates who, you know, some were complaining, I'm not going to get my grade, I can't graduate. But a lot of students, at least at UCLA's campus and on Rutgers campus as well, Rutgers is interesting, where people came out. And I think they recognize the precarity in that maybe the future of the graduate students could be their future too,
right?
You know, so that's where it is. But on the other hand, everything that you just said, that's a good question. I think we need to have movement on these questions. I just feel like some people feel so defeated, you know?
Defeated, I think, you know, exhausted, in debt, concerned. We could ask that question about any number of sectors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Across our society. You know, the anti-racist movement got funneled into the Biden presidential election and the Georgia Senate races. But we could also ask, where is that in its mass form? The attack on transgender people and and LGBTQ people more broadly, you know, where is that movement? And so I think that there's a kind of shock and awe from the right. And I think it also speaks to a level of, you know, disorganization and disorientation and fragmentation among the social forces that actually have the capacity to respond to this.
Right.
And so we have the objective conditions that exist for mass movement, and then the subjective questions of like how to do that that still confront us.
Right. Exactly. And speaking of attacks, there's a really good question here about the attacks on librarians in libraries. And the question is, how does it relate to the broader attacks we've been discussing so far?
I mean, I think that I tried to get at some of this in my essay in the book, which is to say that these forces, the broad spectrum of the right, want to suppress these ideas, want to undermine notions of solidarity, and they really have a worldview of an extraordinary and intense individualism where each person is kind of looking out for themselves. And so there's a denial of institutional oppression or systemic oppression, or the idea that anything is happening, to a group of people, that it's really about your own individual ability to fend for yourself in this society. And I think that they have gotten traction around schools and libraries because it's a place where kids are involved. It's a place where parents can feel some sense of control in a life where you have no control over anything. You can control your kids. You can control what happens at their school. And I think that has created some particular traction around this issue.
Right.
But yeah, it's pretty frightening.
It is. And, you know, the fact that you have all these librarians who are being fired, again, death threats, the fact that, we lived through the culture wars of the 90s, and you know, there was a lot of opposition to Toni Morrison and Gloria Nell and all this, but they weren't actually, very few were actually burning books and banning books and destroying whole bodies of knowledge. However, one of the things, you use the word control, which I think is a really, really key word here, because one of the things that this movement kind of mirrors, although it's like the opposite, is the struggle for community control that I grew up with in the 60s, where, you know, parents, Black and Puerto Rican parents in New York City, for example, in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and even in Harlem, they were fighting to have some say-so over who is hired, what the curriculum will look like in order to expand that curriculum, in order to open up. And here we got this movement under the name of control, parent control, parents' rights, contracting knowledge.
Right. Yeah. And where the parents are always white. I mean, it is astounding, right? Where the media allows these creatures to come on and to proclaim themselves to be acting on behalf of parents. And it the rights of gay parents or of the parents of transgender children, the parents of Black students, of brown students, is completely ignored in this discussion. And I do think, I did write about this in the essay, that 2020 shocked, I think, and scared these people on the right. And I think part of that was the multiraciality of the protest. And they blame schools. They blame colleges. They blame libraries. Right. They blame history and the exposure of students to that history for creating these wells of sympathy and solidarity between young white people and their Black peers. Mm-hmm. And they saw it all over. I mean, in places where, you know, there's a kind of cynical response to the protest in 2020. Oh, white people are participating, so they get credit. Well, if you're in Boise, Idaho, where there are like six Black people, who are you getting credit from, right? In Portland, Maine, where there might be seven Black people, who's giving you credit for participating in an anti-racist demonstration? Mm-hmm. And they will talk about this, the Betsy DeVos or whatever damn name is, Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, they say this openly, that we have got to get this liberal curriculum out of the schools. Right. This is why we're not getting the votes of young people in these elections. And so this is, you know, I think that this speaks to the power of misery that is happening in this society that is generalized in many ways and that is creating solidarities that really frighten the right and, you know, the people with power and authority in this society.
Exactly. And have been doing so for a long time. You know, in terms of we've lived through Campus Watch. We lived through all these different forms of surveillance, which are now just hyped up. You know, it's true. And we do work in the classroom that helps people to think, and that thinking then leads to challenges to what we think of as a kind of naturalized American empire. There's a question from about European countries, and I just wanted to pose it because it's actually a very good question, which, you know, we have the answer to, which is European countries, how do they provide free or low cost university education to their students, going so far as to provide housing and a stipend for students? What's different here? Of course, it depends. Oxford's moving more and more.
Yes.
Or trying to increase tuition. And it just depends on where you are. But it's true. You're talking about, European countries with a longer tradition of social democratic welfare states in which universities don't have to rely so much on endowments And the endowment structure is kind of weird, where you have to raise so much money and live on the interest, like use the interest.
Right.
But then that's not the only source of income. The source of income is tuition. And then with tuition comes grants, you know, some from the Department of Defense, some of it from, you know, petrochemical industries and that sort of thing, and investments on that endowment. So it's a different kind of model for, again, I'm not saying there's not European universities that do some of that as well, but the U.S., that is the model. And, you know, anyway, you may have some things to add to that.
I mean, I would say we could ask that about healthcare in Europe, mm-hmm. ask it about housing. This is about the social democratic welfare state in Europe, as opposed to what we have here, which is a very, threadbare, stingy, effervescent welfare state. That, you know, often exists in the figment of our imagination when it comes to the distribution of social welfare. But I do think it's important to say that that is not some strange altruism in the European character as opposed to the mm-hmm. American character, right? Europe is the kind of home of colonial domination,
right.
Colonial racism, oppression, and terror, which we've seen once again in the suburbs of Paris most recently. But this is the product of a much stronger labor movement. It's the product of a much stronger socialist tradition that vied for political leadership and elections that helped to force the European various European states to create these social democratic welfare states, and so, you know, there's a long history of the question of why socialism hasn't adhered in the United States, some of which, you know, you could take aspects of this conversation to try to understand that, but that is the main difference. It's not a kind of more altruistic, or the European state leaders care more about their populations than the state leaders here. It's a different kind of political tradition that forced European states to produce these social goods.
Exactly. And the social goods they provide in the metropole, sometimes they, right. as you said, there's colonialism, and then there's a kind of neo-colonial order in which, you know, a lot of surplus ends up, you know, in situations where they have it,
right.
At the expense of others, and sometimes in the form of finance capital. But our friend Laura, she has a question, the great scholar and psychoanalyst on Palestine. So she's saying this logic mainstreams a familiar fascist discourse, as we note. What is your sense of the most important pressure points for us to push on as fascism constitutively recalibrates? It's an excellent question. Probably the one we may end it.
Yeah. Why don't we end with this? You know, I mean, that is the question. I guess I'm not sure with this kind of generalized attack what the particular pressure point is, but I do feel like the need to respond is very important. I think that, you know, I talked about a kind of cynical response to some of the 2020 protests, questioning the multiracial character of them. But I think that another phenomenon is to question the need for protests themselves. That, you know, have we outlived the protest, you know, demonstration itself? And, you know, I think that it's clear that demonstrations alone are not enough. But I do think that opposition to this kind of bewildering political agenda of the right is important. And I mean a visible and vocal opposition in the streets is important both as an unassailable denial that we accept this, you know. Secondly, as a way for our side to see itself. I mean, that was part of the power in 2020, is that after this intense period of isolation from the immediate onset of COVID, it is easy to buy into the narrative that the right is so aggressively pushing, and that Democrats often acquiesce to, is the kind of fetish of the individual and individualism, and that it's just about you. And you're either the only one who thinks this way or cares about this particular thing, or this is only your problem. And the protest burst through all of that and allowed all of us to see each other, and that these were concerns that we shared as a humanity and as a society. And I think that is incredibly important. And then out of these protests, I feel like we have to create organizations, and we have to create easy entry points into organization, into organizing. That organizing isn't just for paid staffers. It's not just for paid, you know, for people who organize as a profession, but that organizing and activism is for anyone who cares about what is happening in the world. And out of that have to be developed a set of politics that explain the crisis, explain what is happening around us, explains the relationship between these different attacks as a foundation for building solidarity, and for an argument of why we have to fight together, and that an injury to one is an injury to all. And then to me, the last part of this is that the protest over social questions has to connect with labor. Mm-hmm. We have to reinvigorate the connection between the economic and the political, and that the labor movement really is the next frontier, which means we all need to support the UPS workers. We all need to support the SAG workers. We all need to support these picket lines and to really build this connection between the political and social struggles and the economic struggles that really are the foundation of rebuilding a much stronger left in this country.
Right. Right. No, I agree. I say ditto to all that. And I would add one more thing briefly, and that is, and this is something that I've been learning. I just recently finished Alberto Toscano's forthcoming book, Late Fascism, which I would suggest to everyone. And one of the things he reminds us is that liberalism is not the opposite of fascism. And so part of what happened, as you know, from spring 2020, was you had this potential emerging a kind of abolitionist politics, which then got derailed by liberalism, as happens. And liberalism as the response to what even liberals are calling fascist.
Right.
You know? And so that liberalism played itself out in terms of we need to get a good, we need to believe in the system, ensure that you get to go out to vote and support a Democrat, not a spoiler, to make sure that the fascist is not in power. And, you know, people can be mad if I said, well, what was the outcome? I mean, you know, yes, Trump wasn't in power, although he's about to be elected. okay, well, I shouldn't
say
that.
That's another show.
But ultimately, liberalism derailed what was a deeply anti-fascist movement, because you can't have anti-fascists that's not anti-capitalist, because, you know, the ground in which fascism emerges is capitalism. And so, you know, so I think the book is really important. And the final note on this is that what's important about Toscano's book is that what he does is he looks at anti-fascist thinkers and theoreticians, many of whom are come out of anti-colonial movements, anti-racist movements, anti-capitalist movements. From George Jackson, Angela Davis, as you know, to Herbert Marcuse and others who've been thinking about, you know, a critique of fascism that's not about making a list of characteristics, you know. But we have a lot of work to do, and I'm with you. You know, we have a movement. Our history has always been contraband, and not just Black history, but any kind of radical history that, you know, critiques the status quo in this settler colonial orientation. So with that, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Kianga. It's always fun. Wish we lived in the same city, can hang out.
I know. You know? Yeah. All right, Robin.
Yes, and thank everyone for showing up. And don't forget, get this book. It's really interesting.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.